Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power, and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. Hello and welcome back to the Americano podcast. Today we are going to be talking about the rather large and grandiose sounding theme of reviving the American mind, which is the cover of the latest edition of the Spectator's World Edition, and that went to press on Friday last week. And the reviving of the American mind, people who see the cover will notice, intelligent readers as we have, will notice that it's a play on The Closing of the American Mind, which is a very important book by Alan Bloom in 1987. And the theme of the edition is that Donald Trump's executive orders on education have given higher education a great opportunity to undo quite a lot of damage that has been done to the American education system in the last few decades. And there are lots of good pieces in the edition. I highly recommend everyone subscribe and read it as soon as possible. In that edition, there is an excellent interview with Christopher Rufo, who is a very important figure in this educational moment, if we can call it that. And that interview was conducted by our editor-at-large, Ben Dominich, who joins me now. Ben, welcome. For our listeners, we have quite a few UK listeners on this podcast. For our listeners who don't know about Christopher Rufo, explain who he is, what he's been doing, why you spoke to him, and what you spoke about.
Thank you, Freddie. And it's great to talk to you. I was thinking about Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind in anticipation of this interview with Christopher Rufo. It's obviously this copy that I have, talks about, number one national bestseller and 750,000 copies in print. It was one of these rare books about academia. This is a copy from 1987, so it's a lot more now. It's one of these rare moments where a book about higher education, of all things, actually became a bestseller. And it also is notable for something that is quite interesting about it, which is the shift that happened within the book. And you may be familiar with this because it's one of those storied moments in the history of book publishing, where a major decision actually had huge consequences in terms of the ramifications. The editors involved, including Adam Bellows, Saul Bellows' son, shifted a portion of the book that was in a later portion of the book up to the front. And it was kind of what you might call the scare the parents part of the book, which is, this is what's wrong with the students right now. This is what they get wrong about the development of the mind, how universities are failing to serve them, etc. And in the world of book editing, which I did briefly in my past life, it is kind of infamous as being an example of, this is the power of a book editor to make something, in the same way that you would say, a movie editor moving a sequence in the movie or deciding to do something like that makes the difference between it being a blockbuster and being forgotten. The same is true of The Closing of the American Mind. And so Christopher Rufo, who I think is an interesting figure for a number of different reasons, has been for the past several years, though not as long as I perhaps thought when I first started researching him, a key figure on the American New Right. And I would not describe that as the same as the national conservatives, or how you might call them, but essentially he adopts a posture toward higher ed, which has much more in common, I would say, with the attitudes of a less optimistic and more realist generation of thinkers in the history of American conservatism. If we have gone through recently a period of time coming out of the Reagan years, and where the ideology of Jack Kemp and Paul Ryan of the American Enterprise Institute and others was one that essentially was designed to say the long march of the left through American higher ed institutions has been a very bad thing, but our response to it is not to burn those institutions down or to attack them directly. It is instead to try to push them toward better behavior, toward institutional reform, and to try to retake them gradually through the power of ideas, as opposed to any type of frontal political policy or cultural attack. Rufo takes the opposite position. It's one of the reasons that I asked him a bit in our interview about Richard Nixon and some of the lessons from his experience. Because politically, I think Rufo's attitude is one that says the higher ed institutions that we're talking about are no longer just corrupted by the left. They're actually anti-American institutions. They teach at odds with the American founding, even if they came from it and the Enlightenment background that was the, underneath it in terms of a foundation. And because of that, he essentially has gotten into multiple fractious incidents with the people of the kind of classical liberal ideology who and still are holdouts in some of these institutions. One thinks of Robbie George at Princeton, Alex Tabarrok at at George Mason and others. He brought them up by name in my interview with him. And he essentially fundamentally believes that those people are being used to shield institutions by being the token conservative, the token classical liberal, the token libertarian with a foothold within these institutions when the vast majority of what they do is, as I said, at odds with American priorities and the Enlightenment values that they claim to espouse. I'm happy to get into a little bit about his biography and the like, but he is a fascinating figure. He's set to win one of the most prestigious prizes that exists for American conservatives, the Bradley Foundation Prize, in the coming month. And it seemed the right time to sit down and talk to him about his view of American higher ed.
Well, let's combine a little bit of his biography with what he's doing. Because, like a lot of very important figures on the American right, he started out as a Democrat. And in a way, he could be as sort of influential as key neoconservatives were to the conservative movement in the 70s and 80s. Because he presents himself as somebody who is radically altering the way Americans think and being much more aggressive about it.
Yes, he's aggressive and he's public. I doubt that American Republican voters or parts of the Trump base could name, pretty much anybody within the higher ed reform movement other than Chris Rufo. But he does have that level of prominence, and he's become that, quite frankly, in a very short period of time. It was interesting to me to go back and look at his record and see this is a fellow who in 2017, in 2018 was making documentaries for PBS that you can still go back and see. It creates kind of an odd circumstance where here he is, for the Public Broadcasting Foundation, saying, giving essentially a visual component to Charles Murray's coming apart. And I think that what you learn when you talk to him is essentially, he came up in the mid 2000s, intending to he went to Georgetown here in Washington, and was intending to go into the foreign service of some kind, an NGO or the State Department. That's what a lot of people who go to Georgetown, who are Democrats, intend to do. It's very good at producing those types. But what he found there was that he just could not take the hypocrisy of so many of the people around him as something that was a good or beneficial thing for the American people. He viewed them as being posturing, as being political climbers, caring more about power than actually caring about outcomes. And what that really led him to do was to start reading some of this conservative literature from, he cites Tom Sowell and Shelby Steele, among others. And also Murray, who's coming apart, people will recall, was something that really outlined, the beginning of what people felt about what led to the Trump election in 2016. And what he really took away from that was that these higher ed institutions that were supposed to be producing, an elite that would serve the people, was not doing that at all, and started to really critique it very publicly, along with, he's a white male. He's in a circumstance, I think, there at a particular time when DEI policies were kind of at their peak, and he became a very vocal critic of them, and did so, at a time when a lot of these questions had still not been really resolved by the courts. You had the Harvard Asian discrimination case, for instance, and you had, a number of different, other things that were playing out within, the realm of this. You saw, of course, the cancellation attempts that went rife at that same time period on major Ivy League institutions across the country. You saw the shutting down of speakers. And I think that that all came together to really help him form a narrative about these institutions as being ones that were actually crippling America's intellectual best and brightest, and doing so in a way that led them to basically fall in line with an agenda that he views as being anti-American. And the other thing that's an aspect of him that I think is really interesting is he became someone who is very open about his tactics. Oftentimes when people are activists, they keep their tactics close to the vest. They don't necessarily, expose what they're actually trying to achieve. I mocked him a little bit in our conversation for being the worst Straussian, like someone who actually goes out there and just tells the world what he intends to do and how he intends to do it. But he actually said that originally was slightly accidental, but then it became something that he deploys quite a lot because he wants to explain to the audience that he has on social media, which is quite large, and across other media as well, why he is picking a fight, why he thinks that something is actually worth doing, and saying, some of these things, I think, publicly, was quite helpful to them. And then, of course, there is the instance around Claudine Gay, the Harvard president who took the stand in front of in a committee hearing in front of Elise Stefanik on Capitol Hill just a few years ago that turned explosive, and really because the she and other college presidents, I mean, this is a thumbnail, but they were viewed as essentially saying that anti-Semitism is an act of academic freedom, despite the fact that their own honor codes, their own codes as colleges and universities, do not tolerate other forms of discrimination, and are quite clear about that subject, and punish people for doing that type of thing. Except it seemed like they were giving anti-Semitism a carve out because of some of these pro-Palestinian protests that were happening on campus. At that time, Ruffo was given through a source some information about Claudine Gay that actually turned out to have been fluttering around online for quite some time, ever since she was named to the Harvard presidency, among some disgruntled academics, that she had plagiarized significant portions of her work over the years. And him hammering away on that topic and then having other media entities and then actual, key supporters of Harvard and, alumni and prominent graduates complain about this as being something that was unacceptable for their president. It was, ultimately what led to her stepping down from that presidency, and which is about as big of a scalp as you could possibly have in American higher education.
And where he has led or gone, the administration has followed. Obviously, now there's the war with Harvard, as it's called, which is shaping up to be quite some fight. And also, I've noticed in the executive orders that Trump has produced, for instance, says ending radical indoctrination in K through 12 schooling. The language that the order is written in almost reads as though Ruffo had written it himself. How influential do you think he
He
is?
would not tell me that he had, but I would not be surprised if he was in the room when that was happening, let's say.
He was involved. Yeah, he could be actually sort of involved in the drafting of these.
The interesting thing about this is that it's pretty rare that you see someone go from being an outside activist, fomenting against something that is not a natural priority of the Republican Party. Most Republicans don't, view these institutions as being ones that they necessarily even want to send their kids to. After the flare-up at Columbia, for example, just a few years ago, I recalled speaking to a number of different, Republicans who went there, who said, well, that's now off the list, for my kid. And one of the things that I think has happened is because he identifies this so well, and because he has this philosophical approach to it that stands it out and is, is tied to, I think, his ability to use language to activate people and to make strong arguments. That has put him in a position where, just despite his relative youth and the fact that he hasn't been some long time activist in this space, he has rocketed to the front of the line, in part because of how aggressive he's willing to be. He views this as a power dynamic where the right has been reluctant to use the power that they have, either over these institutions when it comes to tax policy that has obviously made them exempt and allowed them to grow quite wealthy for so long, or when it comes to the fights that happen within the campuses themselves, where he believes that the attitude should not just be, this is a debate society, and I'm satisfied with a moral victory. He wants to have fundamental policy changes, and that's something that has led him to partner with other equally, aggressive officials on the state level. He was someone closely associated with Ron DeSantis, and has been a key part of some of his projects in his state of reforming those academic institutions, particularly the new College of Florida, which has seen a lot of resistance from the left, taking a liberal arts school that was kind of quiet and forgotten and trying to turn it into an example of a better kind of institution. We'll see how much success they have with that in the long term. But also being someone who basically has the ear of this White House and of the education reform establishment in Washington in a very rapid way. Obviously, they haven't been there for very long. There's only so much you can do in a little over 100 days. But he certainly, I think, is a key component of the number of reforms that are going to be part of this Trump administration over the next 4 years.
Well, and a key part of this discussion is, you've touched on already, anti-Semitism and anti-Semitism on campuses and so on. And we have another piece in this edition from Amy L. Wax, who's an almost cancelled professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And she touches on it too. But there is a counter-argument to a lot of what the Trump administration is trying to do in higher education, which is say, you're supposed to be for free speech. This is the whole thing. You're against canceling people because of their opinions and so on. And yet you seem to be making an exception for criticism of Jews or criticism of Israel. You're saying that won't pass. And there's a flaw in the Trumpist position there. Is there some legitimacy to that point?
So I think that the legitimacy that's offered by that point, of course, is that free speech is has been something that they've beaten the drum on for for a very long time, in part because and motivated by the belief that conservatives were being canceled for saying things that were well within the realm of intellectual debate, meaning that they're not going on campus and saying, espousing Hitlerian views, and yet they were being described as fascists and the like. And that's something that you saw apply to, not just Charles Murray and Ann Coulter, but to very benign conservative figures, across the board in a lot of incidents. So that was where that argument really came from. But I never really believed that these people were free speech absolutists, because if they were, then they would say that you could stand up and defend Hamas on campus and hold that view, openly and not be canceled. I think, though, that there is another degree of this that is part of their argument, which is that some of the things that are backing these elements on campuses are outside figures and outside forces that are trying to force Jewish students into a position where they no longer feel safe on campus. And that, I think, is a line that in each of these instances has to be adjudicated, because if it was any other group, if it was Muslims on campus feeling unsafe, if it was Hindus on campus or Christians on campus or Black or other minority groups that were feeling unsafe on campus because of the rhetoric that was being said, that's something that these arguers from the right say that would become an issue. It would be an issue that had to be adjudicated through the normal forms that these universities have adopted as a part of their acceptance of federal funds. Of course, there's a handful of colleges, universities in America that do not accept federal funds, places like Hillsdale, because they believe that they should have the power to decide all of these things for themselves. But the vast majority, of course, do. It's essential to their functioning as in this environment, especially with the costs associated with higher ed today. And so a lot of this is if you're going to take federal dollars, then you're going to have to live up to these rules that you have embraced in the past, at least in the language that you've used. And that again is kind of the aggressive side of what Rufo and those who agree with him want to do, because they feel that conservatives have essentially allowed these leftist or liberal quote unquote liberal entities to be off the hook, where the rules only apply in one direction and not in the other. And so that's a big part of this too. And of course, you also have associated with this, the issues related to Title IX, issues related to and the NCAA and sporting, the way that women and male athletes are treated. It's a whole ball of wax in terms of the kind of things that are going on here within American higher ed. And these are some of the biggest institutions in some of these states. They were, attached often to, medical schools and the major institutions that are, a big boon in terms of not just the states themselves, but for international students who come over. So there are tensions there. And I think that it's incumbent upon them to defend why they believe that, some of this speech is dangerous and should be shut down, goes beyond the pale, and is not simply a representation of opinion, but is actually going to foment violence against students on campus, as we've seen, and sadly, in some instances. And that's, I think, a tension that, Rufo and his cohort will have to navigate. But their priority, as I said, is they believe that this is an existential fight about the future of the American university. They believe that they can pull the levers of power in order to influence the kind of students that are produced, the kind of things that are taught, and to push back against what they believe to be, as I said, anti-American, revisionist history, and the forcing of an ideology, that is designed to put all of these students in a box for the tune of $500,000 in the case of some of these institutions.
Yes, and the anti-American thinking sometimes comes from within America, but is quite often, as you alluded to there, it's coming from foreign donations, it's coming from particularly China when it comes to medical research and so on, is buying up chunks of American academia, as it is in countries all over the West. And it seems pretty obvious, even if it's not very direct or blatant, that that is influencing American academia in certain directions. And that is going to be a big part of the Trump administration's fight.
Yes, the influence of China and the influence of Qatar, I think in particular, are the two things that have really risen up in terms of the conversations that I've had with Trump officials as being something that they want to go after. And part of that, again, is if you want to have these types of deals and influences on campus, that you have to report them, they have to have clarity to them, they have to be something that people know. And a lot of these institutions, from the perspective of the Trump administration, have played kind of fast and loose with that. We've also seen even higher levels of corruption, of course, including, officials that have turned out to be actual representatives of the foreign governments involved, as opposed to merely influenced by them. But one of the things that, has happened here is these institutions have grown in such prominence and attracted so much foreign investment, foreign students and such, is that we've been importing influence from outside, that has taken hold within some of these institutions. And that certainly is something that the Trump administration views as being unacceptable. They have the attitude, I think, that is aligned with Rufo, that is basically, if you're going to take American taxpayer dollars, then you're going to teach the things that we believe you ought to teach. And that does not include a whole host of different things that they have gotten rid of. They've gotten rid of, a number of different programs that were designed to influence what these universities taught from within the federal government, already, either as part of the DOGE initiative or under Secretary of Education Linda McMahon's prerogative. But I don't think they're stopping anytime soon. I think that they want a real cleaning of the house when it comes to higher ed generally. And we'll see at the end of the day, how much impact this has in terms of the place of higher ed within American society. If you want to have higher ed perform the way that a lot of these Trump individuals think that it ought to perform, it needs to be teaching a lot of these people things that are outside of the realm of the liberal arts. It needs to be teaching them a lot of skills related to STEM and related to their ability to function in what Trump is re-envisioning as an American economy that brings back a much more significant form of, high-tech manufacturing and the like, which itself, of course, is a very open question if they're going to be able to be successful doing that.
When we talk about patriotism, pro or anti-American forces in American academia, talking about that in those patriotic, even sometimes nationalistic terms can make, if you like, wet Brits like me quite nervous. I think we tend to think of education as something that is not necessarily bound up with inculcating a sort of national pride. But that's not really the way it works in America, is it? I mean, American schooling is very focused on the nation. I see you've got the flag behind you there. Our viewers, our listeners will not be able to see that. But explain to us, for British listeners, how differently Americans think about this.
Well, I think that this is a conflict that the left has adopted for quite some time, which is to say, a tearing down of the American founding generation and key American figures over the years, whether through critiques that are based in reality or revisionist history that essentially denies any good about people because Thomas Jefferson owned slaves or something along those lines. And that, I think, has been a significant battle in America over the last several decades, in a way that has been taken over not just by the progressive academic left, but by a large portion of the Democratic base. I mean, you think of something as benign, from my perspective, as the argument over Christopher Columbus. And one of the things that is you see kind of in a repeated fashion here is that every 20 or 30 years, there seems to be more revisions that take people who were, held up in the past as being figures that it was actually good for America to laud. And then, they're looked at again, and you have the great panorama showing their success painted over because, they've now been deemed, unacceptable. That kind of thing has happened a good bit in California. Columbus is a good example because, of course, the institution of Columbus Day was a more recent American phenomenon designed to be a defense and a moment of pride for Italian Americans, who at the time, immigrating into America, really didn't have a lot of people to point to where they could say, we are truly American. This is an example of why we are American. We're proud of Christopher Columbus. To then have him be a figure who you saw having his statues cut down during the summer of George Floyd, thrown into the water in a few places, and generally covered with graffiti, that was something that became kind of a flashpoint of, is this someone who we are allowed to honor within the American pantheon? We have a Columbus Day, here, obviously. Or is it something where we have to get rid of that and we have to instead replace it with Indigenous Peoples Day and be kind of in the apologetic form of the Canadians, whenever they have to give a land apology, based on where they're standing. And that was a real flashpoint for Americans where the American right really bested the left. The left really, I think, went too far. They overreached. They started attacking people, not because of police violence or things like that, but of basically calling everyone a colonizer or a colonialist, even stretching down to American foodstuffs and the like, and, which, of course, food itself, all food is cultural appropriation from my perspective, one way or the other. But it's one of these things where I think that dynamic made a lot of Americans who hadn't really been paying attention, not just to higher ed, but to the earlier forms of education during the pandemic, who started listening to what their young students were hearing on Zooms with their teachers, to view America's education establishment as being ones who only wanted to run down the people that they viewed and their neighbors and friends and fellow churchgoers viewed as being American heroes as being the people that you were supposed to look up to and respect and aspire to. That's the reason that tourists come to Washington, D.C. and go to Mount Vernon and are moved by what they see. They go and they visit the Jefferson Memorial and they go and visit the Lincoln Memorial, and they don't see the same kind of thing that the left sees from their perspective in those figures. That, I think, was a huge turnoff to independent voters politically, who share more in common with the traditionalist American conservatives. And so you had this dynamic go on where basically the left has thrown all that away. There's an old comment from a couple of there's different people who've said this in one form or the other. But the Democrat who said it most recently, Lee Slotkin, from the newly elected senator from Michigan, has advocated for Democrats to become more pro football, more pro flag, tougher, stronger. She uses the example of the Detroit Lions head coach Dan Campbell, who is a rough and tumble coach within the NFL, as being the kind of tone that Democrats need to have. And she includes in that, of course, that they should embrace the flag. Democrats losing the Bible, the cross, the flag, the icons of American history is something that I believe now smart Democrats understand has held them back in recent years. And it's part of this overall dynamic as associated with American education.
And Tim Walz is too pale a version of that.
Yes, I think he's quite too pale a version of that, and a little too, I think his indictment of Republicans is weird. Turned out to be something where he was looking in the mirror when he said it. So,
Ben, thank you very much for coming on to Americano. And thank you also for your excellent piece in this month's edition, which, again, I highly recommend everyone subscribe to. The reviving of the American mind means the revival of critical thinking. And I think Spectator readers, and we hope writers, possess critical thinking in abundance. So thanks very much, Ben. Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.